for all everlasting.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. When you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be strong.
Well, I hope our connection is strong this evening. We're at least off to a better start than we were a week ago. We have a connection. I know we have Captain Kirk on the line. How are you, Kirk?
As good as I can be. It's Shabbat Shalom.
Yeah, Shabbat Shalom. We may have JB joining us. I don't know if this is another week that he is off or he will be able to join us this evening. I do want to begin by pointing out something that, you know, sometimes when you are a lone voice crying out in the wilderness and you're saying something that is really important and how it's going to impact the future, and you are the only one saying it, and it turns out to be wholly and completely true, it's probably worth saying, I told you so, only for one reason, and that is that we gain tremendously from the perspective Yahweh has provided. And by using it, we're able to see the world far more clearly than most everyone else. The point I was making was actually confirmed a week ago, and I've just forgotten to speak about it. But the U.S. has intercepted a huge treasure trove of diplomatic and military and intelligence communications between Iran and Iraq. And according to the New York Times, who has surveyed all of them and the ones that I have written, what the Iraqi government officials, their military officials, their intelligence officials, their government officials are telling the Iranians is that our military is your military. Anything we have is yours. And what I had said years ago was that by invading Iraq and deposing a dictator that was a madman for sure, horrific as a matter of fact, but clearly the best dictator in the Islamic world, the only dictator in the Islamic world that was wholly opposed to Islamic terrorism, that the consequence would be to give Iraq to Iran. And in this war that America squandered $4 to $5 trillion, some say more, and more than 10,000 American lives directly and more than a quarter of a million American lives indirectly through suicide, that all we did was make a very bad situation infinitely worse. And that ultimately, because we tried to impose democracy on people that whose religion was completely alien to it, that all we would do is give the majority Shia in Iraq the opportunity to unite their country with Iran. And that is precisely what happened. And these intercepted cables prove it, undeniably. And it's, of course, worse than that. It's not only that America's squandered over $4 trillion, and if you count the suicides, which you should, 250,000 American lives and 1 million Iraqi lives. We created the Syrian civil war and the vast migration out of Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Libya, where we intervened inappropriately as well, into Europe that has fundamentally changed Europe, exacerbating anti-Semitism, making it impossible now for Jews to survive there. And we changed the balance of power in the Islamic world from being dominated by Sunnis, who outnumber Shias by 8-2. But by giving Iraq to Iran and then by destabilizing Syria, giving Syria to Iran, we created the beginning of World War III. It was the worst series of blunders probably in American history. And it was absolutely and unequivocally predictable before the first shot was fired. And I can say that with great confidence because I predicted it. And now we have to endure the consequence. The other thing I wanted to mention is that I listened to a congressman explain why he didn't think that Trump should be impeached on the Ukrainian debacle. And while I agree with him that he should not be impeached, this congressman also said that what Trump did was immoral, was unconscionable in terms of diplomacy and in the terms of essentially bribing a nation with money that's not his own to dig up dirt on a political rival. And that even though he had done such a thing, that didn't rise to the level of an impeachable offense where someone the American people had elected should be thrown out of office. And I agree with him on both of those points. But what he went on to say is how this affair has somehow sullied the reputation of the Ukraine, and how the Ukraine is on the front lines of Russian aggression. Well, that's an absolute lie. The United States is on the front line of Russian aggression. They're causing it. We're the aggressor.
Mm-hmm.
And that the Ukrainians are not innocent and deserving people for $400 billion worth of American weaponry. It is easily in the top five most corrupt countries on earth. They're the people who impose the worst pogroms on Jews.
Mm-hmm.
This is a despicable country. And we ought not be financing them, but that's what we are. And this congressional investigation ought to be in the stupidity of increasing tensions worldwide by instigating instability in the Ukraine for the express purpose of legitimizing NATO and delegitimizing Russia.
Mm-hmm.
We've made the world a much riskier place, and we've done nothing but harm and been dishonest in the process. So those are the 2 points I wanted to make, you know, apart from the story that we're going to tell of the Torah. And for those who prefer that after all of those years of shattering myths, I stay away from political commentary. The more I translate Yah's word, the more I realize that God is extraordinarily judgmental of religious and political activity. And we ought to be as well. And that unless we and others expose and condemn the malfeasance of the United States, which is the most influential country in the world, and other nations and religions, Christianity and Islam, we make it ever more difficult for people to break free of these things. And until they break free of them, they're not going to be open to the truth. So I think it is incumbent upon us to do this.
I was just going to ask, you talked for years about this in the Middle East and what the ramifications would be, and it's a logical analysis. It made perfect sense then from every aspect that you covered it. When all the Muslims moved to Europe, it was pretty obvious that that was going to change the whole dynamic of Europe. When we talk so much about the second Babylon, or the second Exodus, rather, being from America, because that's where the vast majority of Yehudim that live outside of Israel are, what do you think the catalyst will be? And I can see what the catalyst is in Europe that would cause them to leave. What is the catalyst that will cause them to leave the United States and go back to Israel?
Well, there is a movement in academia that is now becoming more and more pervasive in the media and in politics to isolate and condemn Israel. Asher right now is deciding that this is not a time for us to do this show, but that it is a time for me to play with her favorite toy. And unfortunately, she is pulling at all of the cables to the computer and to the phone. So we're going to try to encourage her to find this is an opportunity perhaps to take a nap, which is, I'm sure, I put a lot of people to sleep, but normally even the dog. Kirk, the pervasive nature of academia's assault on Israel has made it almost impossible for Jews to attend college. It is so pervasive, and it is so anti-Semitic. And what we find, and I think you've studied this in your past, is that that which becomes universal in academia soon finds itself as universal within the framework of the society.
Mm-hmm.
An example would be in homosexuality and homosexual marriage. It became the cause célèbre in academia to speak of it favorably and to raise it to the point of pride. And within 20 years of them doing that, 90% of Americans who were opposed to homosexual marriage changed such that now about 70% favor it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I only bring that as an example. As you know, I've got nothing against homosexuality.
No.
And having translated the statements that are wrongly attributed to it, I don't find that, I'm certain that God's not pleased with it, but there really is no direct mention of homosexuality in the Torah. But I just use that as an example. So What we're going to see is that in the media, all reporting regarding Israel is going to be to blame Israel. Israel is bad. The Palestinians, you know, deserve their country. The two-state solution is necessary, and that anybody who is opposed to it is a right-wing nutcase and a nationalist that ought to be disregarded. And look what just happened with Netanyahu. I mean, Netanyahu is likely to be convicted on charges that if he has committed them, then he is the cleanest politician on the planet. I mean, they're charging him with accepting pink champagne and cigars, and for dealing more favorably with news agencies that deal more favorably with him than he does with those that are unfavorable to him.
Oh.
If that is all the man is guilty of, give him his star and move on.
Yeah.
But they want to devour. They want to devour him. And so Israel is eating their own. But that's the biggest problem in America. Of course, in America too, you have a villain that I had really not foreseen, but it's pervasive, and that is that conspiracy. And you know how aggressively and unpopularly as well I've attacked conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the number one conspiracy in the world, and in the United States in particular, is blame the Jews.
Yeah.
It always has been. It likely always will be. And what we're seeing now is a rise worldwide, and even here in America, of neo-Nazis and conspiracy advocates that want to blame Jews for everything. And they're, if you read their manifesto, what they say about Jews, they themselves are guilty of, and Jews have never been guilty of.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they say that they need to kill Jews because Jews have this plot, this genocidal plot, to destroy the planet. And it's just factually untrue. As a matter of fact, in the chapter, the Mizmor 89, that we have been reviewing, what we'll find is that the instigator of the Blame the Jews plot is Paul.
Yeah.
He's the one whose influence on the Christian New Testament made the book grossly anti-Semitic. And so there is a sharp rise of conspiracy advocates, and right now they feel tremendously empowered. And I was chatting the other day about what the consequence would be if Trump is impeached. Now, you know, I'm not a Trump advocate by any means, but I recognize that the 40 to 45% that are devoted to him, they are largely conspiracy advocates, and they are largely right-wing, and they will rise up. They're not going to take that. And in the process of attacking and lashing out at the fake news, they're going to blame Jews, and lashing out at the secret clandestine government, they're going to blame Jews. And so those factors will make America exceedingly difficult for Jews to live in. But the most important part of it isn't that Jews will have to leave. Is that for them to survive this mortal existence, they're going to have to want to leave. They're going to have to want to come home. They're going to have to want to do what we have done, which is to walk away from, disengage from politics and religion, and then walk to Yahweh, allowing him to perfect us, trusting and relying on him. And so Well, there will be a lot of reasons that Jews will be harassed and abused, as they have been around the world, and anti-Semitic attacks throughout Europe right now are at the same level they were prior to World War II. It's not just about them needing to leave America to go home to Israel. It's that if they do not make that choice, then ultimately they can't be part of the covenant and there's nothing Yahweh can do for them. You know, he's invited his people home. And, you know, for the next 15 years, Israel is not exactly going to be the a safe place in the here and now, in the mortal realm. But it will be the safest place eternally.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, you and I talked about that before the show began, and that Yahweh does not make any promises. I can't say he doesn't make any promises. He does make some promises to protect us in the in this mortal existence. Not to have our lives be pain-free and not to to prolong our lives, that sort of thing, not to enrich us monetarily in this material realm. But he does make promises to protect those who are engaged in his business, because there's so few that are. Rather important that he keep those who are doing it safe.
Yeah.
So, you
yeah.
know, there's a clue, folks. If you want God to engage on your behalf, you're not gonna, mosquitoes bite me here just as they bite everybody else. My shoulder still hurts. You know, my eyes are growing weaker. It's I'm not getting any, and I'm not asking for any physical benefit, but by doing this, I am protected. By doing this, you're protected. Kirk.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a commitment that Yahweh has made to those who are willing to risk it all for his testimony. And we do.
Yeah.
It's worth doing. And it's worth doing. So anyway, I think all of those things are important for us to know. Now, you did an interesting study, Kirk. You sent me a copy of it a few hours ago,
uh-huh.
And the that study was on names, and you started with the name of Dode.
Yes.
What did you learn?
Well, if I were to express the things that we already know, I'm going to read a little bit just so I can keep it all clear and in sync. But
okay.
I mentioned to you that I always remind myself that the Hebrew language is expressed in concrete terms, and it must relate to our ability to see, hear, smell, speak, or touch to understand those things. We know that Dode, if never before, we certainly know it now, that Dode was a prolific writer, and his writing engages, I thought, very interesting. Writing actually engages all the senses. I mean, if you think about it, you feel the paper, you touch it, you smell it, you're thinking, you're seeing it, you recite it to yourself as you write. I know you do. So it's quite totally engaging. So I kept keeping that in mind.
If you read out loud, and you can, by the way, you can read out loud even
uh-huh.
sometimes by just saying the words inside of your head.
Yes.
And I'll read them such that they resonate inside of me. And a lot of times I just read them aloud. But when you do that, you are engaging, because when you're going word by word, you're actually pronouncing them. You have the tactile experience of your mouth, the tactile experience of your ears. Whether you're using a computer or paper, you've got the tactile experience of the paper
mm-hmm.
and pen, or keyboard and display. And the words are all pictures. Every word is a picture.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so they describe things that are either are pictures, and the most vivid of them are actionable. And so, yeah, it is a all-encompassing experience to read. When I read, I see Yahweh and the words. I just read, I just translated the last passage, Kirk, just to speak about this.
Okay.
We're talking about how the words are exploit all of your senses. I've just transitioned out of Mizmore Psalm 9 and begun 10. And 10 is, if you're a goyim, like the two of us, mm-hmm. you're a goy, you darn
yes.
well better not be associated with any religion or government, because God's going to do the goyim.
Yeah.
Going to wipe them out. Going to wipe mm-hmm. them out.
Yes.
And as we move through God's excoriating commentary on the Gentiles and move into 10, God is actually saying that the Gentiles who, through their religions and politics, invented the devices that were used to abuse people will be caught and forced to endure the devices they invented. When I was traveling through Europe, I made it a point, every time I've been there, to go into every torture museum that is available in almost every city in Europe has one.
Really?
And I do so because I think it's essential to understand how egregious religious and political men have been. And this whole mindset of torturing others is so, you can't call it inhuman because it's obviously human.
Yeah, but it's disgusting.
But it's heinous.
Beyond belief.
Yeah. And you know, when I had to write in this particular chapter about the history of the Inquisition and the Roman Catholic Church and their mm-hmm. hideous influence on humankind, you're constantly forced to deal with the mindset of a religious order that was committed to torturing anyone who challenged even their most perverted motives. And having seen the devices that they deployed, and just how revolting they are, to hear God say that he's going to force the perpetrators to endure the devices that they invented. Talk about
wow.
a visual picture.
I guess. Well, I like you going to those places. I've seen an awful lot of art, both in Europe and America and all the museums, and they depict these things, and they're awful. They're just sickening to look
yeah.
at. I don't know how people can hang them on the walls.
Yep.
These pictures.
And the nice thing is that I think it's I think it's justice. I think it's appropriate. And
I think it is too.
Those who inspired these devices, who invented these devices, who deployed these devices, who encouraged their use, receive 1,000 hours of torment from the same devices for every hour that people were victimized by them. It's fair. It's appropriate.
Yeah, it is fair. Well,
so that gives you just an idea of how words create a visual image. I mean, I translated that, and that's exactly what I saw in my mind's eye.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's I tell you, it's hard for me to read sometimes that stuff that you write. I mean, your research is good. A lot of it I know. A lot of it I've read history books and things similar. And it's just, wow, you've got a strong constitution to be able to do that. To me, sometimes when I read it, I just have to put it down for a while and come back to it later because it's just too much. I don't understand how somebody
yeah.
can invent those kind of things. What is in your mind that you would think that has some value to do for any cause? What is wrong with you.
Yeah, but it's the ignorance of that history, as vile as it is. The entire history of Christianity and the Roman Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
It's ignorance of that history that causes people today to think that the Pope is sitting in the seat of Saint Peter, and that they're God's vicar on earth, and that they're holy men, and that this is a good institution. To come to those conclusions, you have to completely disregard history. And I don't want people to disregard history. I want them to know it.
No. Yeah. Throw it in their face.
You're far less likely to be deceived if you're open to the truth.
Mm-hmm.
The truth isn't pretty. Well, the truth about God is. The truth about man is not. In fact, one of the lines as we were finishing as God was wrapping up the ninth mizmor, it was Dode saying, as it relates to these Gentiles and these mortal men, it's time that you take a stand and do not allow these men to prevail. It's clearly a referendum between God's way and his way. And Dode is saying, don't let man prevail.
No. Hear, hear.
Yeah. All right, so that was a long interruption. Go ahead. So you're
that's all right.
We've
agreed that we'll be active listeners, so that's quite I was counting on that. So anyway, just to move along a little bit, to keep it in perspective, I was looking at the letters and how they lay out and to see what we could see, and I think that in the letters of Doe, there's only two letters in there. One's repeated, the delete or delet, and the I think of it as the doorway to eternal life. And for all the context that we understand about Doe now, it's even more relevant to view it that way, I think. And it's that place where we are increased exponentially by going through that door, becoming as we will be as light, something akin to Yah. And the entrance way is open from either direction, which I thought interesting, being a goy going, our frame is from left to right as opposed to right to left. Whether that has any merit or not, I don't know, but it was an interesting thought. And
it's like Hayez reads the same as right to left as it does to right. So there's kind of an infinite
approach.
Perspective.
Open.
The two doorways represent two related concepts. One is the door to life, and the other is the door to Yahweh's home.
Yes.
So to enter Yahweh's home, you have to go through the doorway to life, which is Pesach, and the doorway to Yahweh's home is opened through the Bereth Covenant.
Yes.
So I think, and that those two doorways are connected, which is what the Wah in the middle means. It makes a connection between things.
Yes,
so
it does associate
there's a connection
together,
being made between
together.
The doorway to life, which is Pesach, and the doorway to God's home, which is the covenant.
Yeah. So with that in mind, what I did is I took the letter Delet and drew it. And we'll be able to post this on James's thing so y'all can look at it and give me whatever comments you think and feedback by next week at least. But I looked at the let, and obviously it's the door, it's the entrance way, it's the Pesach door. And I also mentioned that it's not a passive thing because one has to exert some effort, not a great deal of effort, but some effort to walk through it. It's an entryway into the tent, as you just mentioned, and it's symbolic of the family home. And it's narrow, too. It's a doorway to a tent, so usually not real big. They're not big tents in the Bedouin days. It was a narrow one, and one that goes through, that you would walk through individually. And it's, and of course, it was written twice in his name and Doe's name, which is always for added emphasis, I think, as well, when you repeat something. So I toss that in as well for your consideration. The Wah, when looking at the Wah, is drawn as a tent peg, which we know it secures the home. It's used to extend the space of the home and, in that matter, the people therein. And we all know these things, but here's some things I never considered as I explored it a little bit further. There is a word for the letter D, delete, and it's a delete or delete lam ta. So I decided, well, that, if it's a word, you can analyze it in Hebrew. And so I did. And we can analyze this word as well, and it's a doorway that one passes through, and it's a guide, is guided. The lamb is the guiding influence along the path, and interestingly, the taw represents the signpost along the way, Zion. And I thought, well, you know, I've never done that before. Look at a letter and then analyze how you say the letter or how you would write the letter. In fact, I'm not sure too many languages have a word for the letter. But this is a phenomenal language.
Yeah.
I mean, it really blows me away. So then I looked at the wa, and I did the same thing with it. The wa has the wa aleph hey. So in addition to being the tent peg, it is a nail that attaches things together. And I mentioned that reminded me to think about crucifixion. This holds us together, the things that took place on the upright pole and matzah. The words from and the word for and, adding things together, increasing people and the number of people. The wall represents the goal that we look forward to be, because we want to be increased. We want to become like Yah and have that kind of life so we can move about and through universes and, gosh, unlimited things. The Aleph represents Yah that faces the upright person, the Hay, and is the one who is reaching up to Yahweh. And it may even be evidence of Yahweh initiating, because you had mentioned this in your chapter on the chapter 4. It may be evidence of Yahweh initiating the relationship first, because he's the one that is moving towards this one standing upright, looking up for him. So maybe that's another clue telling us once again that that's a good concept. And then I mentioned to you, and I said, I can find no negative connotations about Dode's name. And then I did one further thing before I left Dode, the word, or his name, rather. Love is Ahab, and I wrote it three different ways. I wrote it A-H-B, or with the Aleph, Hey, and the Bet, in modern Hebrew as well as ancient Hebrew in this script. And it pictures the authority, Eloah, or Eloah, our ultimate shepherd, once again turning to the hay in the upright, in awe position, I call it, both moving towards the family home. And I mentioned, I think that's what King Dode will continually do throughout the future. So that was my happy news on the word Dode. But the reason this was begun is because I was looking at Shaul's name. And Shaul has pretty good letters in it. And at first glance, it looks like a pretty good word. But it was the lamb at the end that threw me. If the lamb at the end, does it make it a positive word? And that was the question I presented to myself. I returned to my book of 500 most used Hebrew words, or verbs rather, recognize that the actionable words define the nouns, to see what I might find. And I found in those, pardon me, I found in those 30 of 38 words ending in the lamb, and they were all overtly negative. Eight words can be negative or positive depending on the context and how they're used in a sentence. And even the negative shading of these was really negative. Now, I'll throw out three. I didn't send you all the stuff I did, but there's some really good ones that I think would be fun to explore for a moment if we have the time. But there are three words that instantly came up that I thought, well, maybe not so, but it is a good example of the positive and negative context of these words. One of them is halal, which just simply means to emit rays of light. But it's also the name of, which would be a positive thing, but the name of, it's also the name of Satan, Halal ben Shakal, which is eminently negative. So in that context, mul, or circumcision, Now, that's a word that I think of as a positive thing because it is beneficial, and, of course, it's the way, what we must do. It's the fifth term and condition of becoming a member of the family.
Of the covenant,
of course, and allows us to partake of Passover, and without it, and we wouldn't be able to. On the other hand, not to be circumcised, remember it is to be, as we have learned, it cuts one into the family, or it can also cut one's out of the family. And interestingly, as J.B. wrote a whole book on it, is the fulcrum of Paul's debate. If he can conquer one of those things in your mind, then you won't participate in becoming a member of the family because there are all these five terms and conditions, and they are not negotiable.
Right.
Then another one came up because we were talking about it last week or the week before, I should say, and it's a yill. That's a really pretty word. I mean, it's a good word, and I thought, well, this would be an exception to the rule. It's the sacrificial lamb, and it's good. It's true. It's right, question mark. But consider what was placed on the lamb. If I was trying to find, well, where's the negative in this, and if you consider what was placed on the lamb, which are the sins of the covenant family, and the only way Yah's soul would have been into Sheol is that it had to be associated with the sins. Therefore, it would make it an extraordinarily negative word. Now, I mentioned something I was reading.
Beyond that, what happens to the Passover lamb?
It gets destroyed.
It gets killed and then burned up or disintegrated.
What happens to the
Christian Jesus?
Well, he's put him in a tomb and raises back up.
Well, wait a minute. If the Passover lamb is supposed to die, and the Passover lamb is supposed to stay dead, but in Christianity, no. Can't be the Passover lamb because the lamb comes back to life.
Correct.
But how is it the Passover lamb?
People bought it.
If it comes back to life.
Yeah. Well, you know, you made a great point when you were talking about, why they buy this myth that the Jews killed Jesus. You know, no, Rome crucified him. There's no evidence that half of the stuff that they wrote about that story is true, other than the fact that they would have killed him. But the thing is, I was thinking about this as I went through this, is you make an excellent point that who led him to the slaughter? Well, the Yehudim led him to the slaughter in the priesthood. That's what they do with the Passover lamb.
Yeah.
That's their job.
That was their job. Oh, yeah. Israel, if the high priest did as the Christian New Testament claims, and not much of what's in the Christian New Testament is true, but if they did, and if they delivered him the Passover lamb, then they did exactly as they were supposed to be doing, because the Passover lamb wasn't delivered, there would be no salvation.
That makes you a really good lawyer.
Yeah, so what they did, even if their motives were wrong, what they did was right. The Passover lamb had to be delivered for the sacrifice. And so why would, does the Torah in any place condemn the parents, the father and mother of the household, for killing the Passover lamb so that it can be prepared to be eaten?
No, you kill it, you put the blood on the door, and you eat the good part and burn up the bad part, the non-perishing part.
Right, and you're encouraged to do it. So the Yehudim, if the story is true, they did what they were asked to do. And thank goodness they did it, because if they had not done it, and the Passover lamb
had
not
been about is moot. Yeah.
Right. Then Passover is moot, and there is no eternal life. There's no doorway to God's home.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah. So I looked at let me see. Did I get Sheol? So now we're looking at Shaul.
Mm-hmm.
And let me see, where, make sure I don't lose my place here. Okay, on page four.
There's two Shauls. There's a person mm-hmm. who God calls the son of evil. He calls him the mm-hmm. father of lies and plague of death. He also calls him the despicable one. And so there's the Shaul that is the most universally condemned individual in the entirety of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. Shaul is the antithesis dote. And then there's the Sheol, which is spelled exactly the same way, which is the worst possible outcome. I mean, there is no worse word than Sheol. And what does Sheol end with?
It's an L. It's on our
yeah, and I know you were doing verbs, and Sheol is not a verb.
No, I know,
Sheol,
but it's an actionable thing.
Is the single most negative word in the entirety of the Torah.
The reason it's in there is because the same or very close to the same spelling, depending on where you're looking, is the same word for to question or to ask or to inquire, which makes it into a verb, but it's one of those verbs, or you can be used as a noun as well. So what I did is I took the list of the ones that I thought were just really, I couldn't believe it. So I'm going to read some of those to you. Now, I'm just going to use the letters, the English letters like ABL for Abal and so forth, but just for the audience's sake. And the ABL, that word, Abal, it means grief, sorrow, to mourn, to wilt, in the flowing way of life. And I want you to think for a minute as I go through these. I want you to see how many of them in your mind or could be applied to what we know about Paul Shaul, the plague of death. A call means to destroy, being devoured by fire, or to be consumed. Badal, another L, all of these are ending with L, which I don't know why I went to look that up, but that's what I came up with. And I went, wow. It means to separate or to divide. Bahal is to disturb, to agitate, and to panic. Balel would be to mix, mingle together, and think Babylon. That's what that means.
So we're five of these five so far apply directly to...
These are all negative connotations. It's hard to go back to the original oldest definitions and those that are said in the context of being understood concretely that you can't find anything positive about them. They're very much negative. You have to go to some modern English.
There's a good shepherd and a bad shepherd, and the bad shepherd is Shaul. And so you've named five the words so far. All five are negative. All five mm-hmm. apply to Paul.
And as we move along, there's Gazal, G-Z-L, and that means to pluck, to take away by force. Now, think about Paul, think about Benjamites, and so forth, and tell me that ain't fitting. Habal is to be empty, the flowing out of contents. It also means to bleed out. Ha,
mm-hmm.
the double H, or Chet, sometimes it's called a Chet, sometimes it's a Het. But the double H-D-L, it means to terminate, to die. Double H-double-L, the Chet again, it means to twist. Who twisted Yah's word better than Paul? None that I'm aware of.
Yeah, or worse.
Halal or Chalal is to pierce with a pointed weapon. I point you back to Yosha. Or, for that matter, they killed everybody, this guy. Yahal is to remain behind, to wait with anticipation. The reason I threw that one in as a negative is because that's what Paul's big prophecy about the rapture. I mean, that's cruel. Yalal is to howl, a loud wail in grief or pain, a howl of a wolf. Duh. The Benjamite wolf. Kasal is to topple, to fall over in death, or from being pushed. Gaal is to be unclean or to be defiled. Kulal is belittle, regard or portray as less impressive or less important, to be light in weight or light in importance, to curse,
lowly and lowly. Just lowly
as,
and lowly.
As making light of.
But
and, of course, he chose the name. He chose the name Paulos, which is in Latin is lowly and little, and is mentioned constantly throughout the Torah, Prophet, and Psalms. Regal, and we get into some really good ones. Regal is to tread about, to be on foot, walking through a foreign land in the sense of spying, is to trample another with one's tongue, with one's words. Think about Paul's missions. That was his job, to go around and trample on everybody with his words. Shaul, we talked about a minute ago, that's to question, to ask, to inquire, and Shaul is the grave, the pit, the hell, or if we like to define it as a black hole, because that seems to be the most appropriate definition of what it would be like. Shaul is to, once again, low, to be small in position or stature, to cast down or to be abase. That's after which a lot of them are going to be after the when Yahweh returns and Doe takes over. Maal is to transgress, to commit an unintentional or, in this case, a treacherous act. How about changing Yah's name or his words or diminishing Doe's name or diminishing Doe? Mashal is to regulate as a ruler, a lord, or to govern over. Now, if you contrast it to what Yah offers as far as he sets us free. In fact, I like the way you do Shah now, better than just saved. He is setting us free. He's let's see, what do you say besides salvation? It's freedom.
Well, Yasha, the Hebrew verb that is typically translated to save. Its primary meaning is actually to deliver. From harm, to liberate, and it's only means to save in the sense that you have been delivered from danger, you have been freed and liberated, and it is it's one of the things that Kirk. Now that you mention it, I had a conversation about this earlier today. When our physical bodies are a tremendous burden and a liability. I mean, you know this now with what Terry is suffering. Our physical bodies are this enormous liability. And to be free of our physical nature is to be liberated not only in time and therefore immortal, but to be empowered and enriched and enlightened. Just the freedom of being away from the constraints of a physical body is the essence of salvation. It's one of the things that makes this whole concept of the Christian bodily resurrection so inanely stupid. But what God is doing, he's not only liberating us from the tendency of men to oppress and subjugate others, providing true liberty. Freedom to individually choose. But he's also liberating us from our physical bodies.
Yes.
So it's a deliverance. And when you think of the word from a deliverance and liberty and freedom perspective, you understand what Yahweh is saying when he says, I delivered you from bondage, from slavery, from oppression, and the crucibles of human oppression and Mitzrayim. He's a liberator, which then flies right into the face of Pauline Christianity, where the Torah is comprised of laws. No, the Torah is comprised of teaching and instruction, and with that teaching and instruction, we are given the opportunity to make good use of our free will.
Well, that's another showstopper when you tell somebody that, number one, that religion means to be bound. Look it up; it's Latin, and then you approach that idea as he's trying to free you and set you free, and then you throw in that the Torah is not law; the Torah is teaching from Yara, guidance, direction, teaching, and so forth. And you present that to them, and then you throw in something that Yahweh can't, that you did in the Tablet of Stones, where you wrote in great line about Yahweh cannot allow you, he cannot command you to do anything if without avoiding, without changing his blessing he gave you as far as being free will. If you have free will, he cannot command you to do something. Why is this desire to rush back to Egypt? Why is this desire to walk back to Babylon? It is just, it's absurd if you think about it. What is wrong with people? All your life you should want to be free. If any country ever preached it, never did it, but if any country ever preached it, was, I'm free. No, you ain't, but you ought to be. You ought to want it more than anything else. And
yeah,
then hopefully
you
will walk in the right direction in your freedom.
The important decision in the universe, which is to participate in covenant, and you need to be free to make that decision.
Yeah, because nobody starts out until they leave this oppressive state they're in, epitomized by Babylon.
Yes.
So, so to be free, and then we had Nepal, NPL, to fall, to descend suddenly and involuntarily through the force of gravity, and I think of that one as I get to watch old Shaul go into the pit. Here's the one that, and I actually had a conversation about this years ago with, I forgot his name all of a sudden. I'm just so embarrassed. But anyway, it was the one in the Northwest that passed away. Richard, I'm sorry. Forgive me, Richard.
Yeah.
And he wrote me and he said, maybe we're wrong about this prayer stuff. And I said, no, I'll tell you what I'll do, Richard. I'll go through every word for prayer. And the one that comes up the most is translated prayer, of course, is Palal, P-L-L, Pay, Lam, Lam. And let's look at what does Palal really mean? To fall to the ground in the presence of an authority and plead to prevent judgment. There is no concept, there's no time, and now through the history of the universe and the history of eternal time that you will ever be in that position or ever be asked to do that or ever won't be have a compunction to do that. Neither will I, neither will any member of the covenant. That is so out of character and so absolutely opposite of Yahweh's plan that it's the stupidest thing in the world, yet that's what they use to tell you to pray.
Yeah.
That's just...
Yeah, it's amazing.
And
you know, I was driving around town here in the BBIs. You constantly see them rebuilding the churches that were destroyed in the 2017 hurricane season with Irma and Maria. And all of them have signs out in front. You know, most huge percentage of people's homes are still without windows, without doors, without roofs. You know, 2 years later, this place is maybe 20% repaired, and yet the work is being done on the churches that were destroyed, and it all says in front of them, a house of worship. Come help us rebuild this place of worship. Join us to worship God. And you just drive by and you say, how is it that over these past 2,000 years, the preponderance of people have been fooled into believing that a superior being would create an inferior being to worship him? And when you just process that and you think about how disgusting that would be, how insecure, how sadistic, really, a being would have to be to create an inferior being to worship him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, it is identical to us creating a slug in the garden and having a slug blurp out, Kirk, you are magnificent. Kirk, I adore you. Kirk, You are just the most wonderful Kirk of all time. Let me bow and genuflect to you, O great Kirk. Let me sing your praises. And if you had created this thing to do that, after about the burp or second, after laughing,
yeah, after
you're push off, you're going to say, okay, this is
okay, that was a mistake.
I'm really sorry. That was a mistake. Oh, what is wrong with
what
people that God wants to be worshipped?
Well, you know, that was the essence of that paper I wrote for him. It was prayer, all the words for prayer, and there's no place like that. But now, unbeknownst to me until today, Jackie sent me the love to him, what you're doing on the next chapter.
Everybody wants to, the problem with prayer, of course, Kirk, is everybody wants to talk to God as if God is somehow going to be impressed with what they have to say. And I'm going to tell you that, you know, I have conversation with God all day long, most every day. And our conversation is decidedly one way. You know, he talks, I listen. And we're going to break that way. He's got lots
of things. Look what it's done for you. Good.
Yes, really, it's been marvelous. And, it's not that it's one-sided in the sense that, yes, if he talks, I listen. And it's an active listening because of the way that I respond and grow and benefit and our relationship grows through it. So he gets a lot out of it, even though he's the primary giver in this relationship. You know, if you approach God the same way, then maybe I just ought to listen to him. You're better off. So stop this nonsense of praying to him. You don't have anything to say that's going to impress him. Nothing you're going to say is going to, you know, God's going to say, wow, I didn't know that. Thank you so much.
Thank you
for
bringing that up, yes. Well, you know, as I walk the dog around the neighborhood and everyone wants to know about Terry and so forth, and every one of them, I take that back, two of them don't, every one of them are, she's in our prayers, we're praying for her and all that. I've told them, I've said, don't pray for her. Yahweh knows what her situation is, and he's in control of our lives, and it's fine. It's you know, I want it well, of course. I wanted to come back here and be my wife again and be out of that hospital bed. But I've come real close, but I can't really ruin the whole neighborhood from my walk by telling them, don't be crazy. But I want to shake them sometimes and say, stop this. Think this through. What I was about to say was that unbeknownst to me until today, I saw your next chapter heading, which is Yahweh's name. And maybe a working title, it may change, but still, I was thinking about this because I was just doing Dode and Shaul's name. But if you look at his name, first of all, you have to think he's obviously not, he doesn't mind, 75% of his name is about his children, and 25% of his name is dedicated to him, and that's his yod, his hand reaching down from above with an open hand to lift up. If he's there to lift you up, and all the characters in there are either studying him or studying his words, drawn that way, pictorially, and if they are standing up, engaged with their legs apart, with their arms up, looking up to above, then why would you even think for a minute that he wants you down on his knees, on your knees, groveling at his feet?
Right.
Where do you find it? You know, you have to make it up. You can only find it with Paul.
Hand opened and outstretched to lift us if, in fact, he wanted us suppressed.
Yeah. I can draw a lot of pictures to make us look depressed, if that's what, or oppressed. If I was going to try to depict that concept, and none of them were found in his language, just none.
All right.
Well, I've now
20 words that you've shared, or 22 that you've shared. 20 of the 22 fit Paul. All 22 are negative, and 20 of the 22 who are negative and apply to Shaul.
Yeah. And there were more that you go both ways, you know, and there was probably a few more. I just try to keep it down to one page. So, but I suggest that if you're interested, go look them up and look at all the L's and then look at the concept. But look through a lot more than one lexicon and see what it really says. It's like looking up a lexicon where you say, this is the law. I mean, come on. Look up all of them and see what it really means, and look at the oldest root words and what the root words mean, which is a habit I've gotten into a lot. Now, the last thing that I offered up to you, or just for your consideration, was Benjamin. And I've thought about this a lot. I was trying to figure out, because both Shauls, of course, are from the line of Benjamin. So it relates in that context. So I said to myself, well, why is the tribe of Benjamin given to the territory of the southern kingdom? Why did Yahweh say this is your part?
One thing that's really interesting about the fact that Benjamin is part of the southern kingdom with Yehuda is that means that they're not part of the northern kingdom that is Yisrael. You know, when Yahweh says he's going to reunite Yisrael and Yehuda, well, Yisrael would include 10 of the 12 tribes.
Oh, I got you. And, then you'd have to include Benjamin
includes one of the of them, and it's never I'm going to reunite Yisrael, Yehuda, and Benjamin.
There's a reason
because
you're
Yisrael
on this show.
Of the 10, and Yehuda is only one.
That's really good.
I've always thought that was an interesting perspective. But so, why do you think that Benjamin was allowed to be part next to Yehuda?
Mm-hmm. Well, I wrote on this that I thought it was the same reason that when you introduce the concept of why Satan was allowed into the Garden of Eden to give them a choice.
Yeah.
These are the people who really kept the records. These are the people who kept the Torahs in available, you know, and so forth. So without them, without this hardcore group that over the centuries in Jerusalem recording and re-recording and re-recording, we wouldn't have these things, and they hid them away in the cave so that they were also found later and so forth. Without that, give them credit. I mean, we have nothing without it. And they protected those things and showed great respect for them. So that is the chosen group of the chosen group. And it's the line of where Dode comes from, and it is just nothing bad I can say about Yehuda. So he's got to put something there as a counterbalance to that, to give him a choice. It's a terrible thing, but there it is. And
Benjamin, that was the one that was Benoni, that was cursed by his mother.
Yeah, I mentioned that as well. He was cursed by his mother. If you read the history of them, all the roads that went through their territory, they were wolf-like. They were always called a wolf. That was their symbol, for goodness sake, when they were camped out in the desert with Moshe. And they were predators. They preyed on the people who came through. They stole. They killed. What is good about them? As a group, they're hideous.
Yep.
They're terrible. I would suggest that perhaps even and Yathrop, maybe Muhammad's daddy must have been a Benjamite. Who knows? Maybe his mother was Yehudim. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if there was some connection. No, well, maybe not, but it's still, there's just nothing good about
it. Interesting, though, that if you look at the Northern Kingdom, Yisrael, they were hauled off into slavery by Assyria. Assyria today is all Islamic.
Yes.
And Yehuda was hauled off into slavery by Rome. And Rome became the Roman Catholic Church.
Yes.
And so you do have Yisrael and Yehuda being attacked and enslaved by the two most prevalent religions in the world, Christianity and Islam, the primary enemies of God and of his people.
Yeah. Now, so many insights in this last chapter, in chapter 4, are so brilliant and so well presented. I'm just stunned again, as I have been for the last 11 or so, 12 years, whatever it is now. I'm just stunned that this is just now coming to fruition. I mean, it's just, it's so obvious when somebody studies it. I realize that we have more material now than ever, computers and so forth. It's just, it's so much stuff you can find out of lexicons and nobody can put it together. I'm just stunned by these things.
Yes, it lays open for all to see that God established Dode as his chosen one, as the one who was the most set apart, as his anointed Messiah, as his beloved son, as the King of Kings, as the shepherd for his people, as the branch from which we would all grow. He established all of these things with Dode. Dode is even his strong arm. Dode is the one who is returning with him. There is a second coming, and it's a Dode. Dode is the one who is being raised, not bodily, but his soul being raised not only to govern in the millennial Shabbat. Dode is so important that he, according to God, he is going to look like the sun in Yah's presence. And so all of these things are said of Dode because, as Yahweh claims, he is the living embodiment of the covenant. Dode is the reason that the universe exists. God wanted to have children, to be part of his family, and his firstborn is Dode. First among all of the children of God is Dode. And so what God is saying is that if you pay attention to this man, if you recognize, no, he wasn't perfect, you realize, you know, he had aches and pains. It wasn't like, you know, I made his life so perfect that, of course, he, you know, he was devoted to me. No.
Well, yeah, why wouldn't he like you? No.
Yeah, he suffered and succeeded in many different ways. And he was both righteous and flawed. But you need to look at what was it about this guy that was so loved, cherished, chosen by Yahweh. You know, why is this man the single most mentioned individual in prophecy?
Well,
and, you know, the answers are so utterly obvious if you take the time to consider them. No one wrote more than Dode. He figured it out, and he shared what he learned. He did what God wants us all to do, to listen to him and then share with others what we've learned. God wants to work through people. He wants to communicate his message through individuals like Dode, who will then share it with the rest of us. The way he works. And this guy was brilliant. He used his intellect to come to understand who God is and what he's offering and what he expects in return. And he also shows us that God is absolutely intolerant of lies, of religious and political corruption. Dode was very judgmental. And what the Mizmor 89 does as well is it establishes the adversary. So Dode is the Messiah. He's the King of Kings. He's the branch. He's the strong arm of God. He's God's protective shepherd. He is his beloved son. The Son of God is dope. And he's, all of these positive things are said about him in contrast to God calling Shaul, the despicable one, who is the son of evil.
Mm-hmm.
And you realize that the entire psalm is a referendum between the covenant and Christianity. One good, one
yes.
bad.
Yeah.
And because it calls out Shaul by name as the adversarial force, it's a referendum between Dod and Shaul. And what you find, according to God, is that his, among many things that he is antagonistic toward Shaul about, Paul,
mm-hmm.
foremost among them is that Shaul took the promises that Yah had made to Dod
mm-hmm.
and gave them to his caricature that he called Jesus Christ. And that by doing that, he took away from Yosha the very thing that he came to achieve, to be the Passover lamb. He took that away from him and gave him everything that had been promised to Dod, none of which applied to him. And it caused people to miss the example that Yahweh was establishing, instead to look somewhere else. And the best, I think, affirmation that God doesn't want us following Yosha, because, by the way, it doesn't work out well for the Passover lamb.
No.
And
he already has a Passover. He had a Passover lamb. He doesn't need another Passover lamb, so don't follow him doing what he does.
Right.
Yeah.
And it doesn't turn out good for the Passover lamb.
No. No, it doesn't.
That when you consider the fact that we have more from Dod in the language that he wrote, Hebrew,
mm-hmm.
than we have from any other individual, and we have nothing from Yosha in the language he spoke. Not a word.
Yeah, well, there's a clue.
There is a reason okay. for that, folks.
Yeah.
So it is. It's a powerful referendum on replacement theology and explaining the basis of it and why God is so opposed to it. You know, if you think that the promises that God made to Israel have been taken from them, as Paul claims, because they killed God and that really pissed God off, think again, because it isn't true.
I can't find Yahweh being mad, this mad at anyone except for one particular reason, or multiple, saying all in one umbrella. He cannot stand religion. He cannot stand politics. He cannot stand militaristic or economic control over people and setting and enslaving them. If he's mad at Jerusalem, I mean, if he's mad at Yehudim, it's because they became religious, not because
yeah.
of Yosha. That's not even part of the
no.
equation. So,
no.
And how many pages have you written, and isn't it the same thing throughout, over and over and over and over again? He hates that, and what he loves about Dod is Dod hated it just as much as him.
Right.
He hated this stuff. He attacks this stuff. He constantly does. And the fact that Shaul appears in these passages, when you really think about them, you start reading them, you go, my gosh, it really is a referendum on Shaul and a debate. Not a debate, it's a slaughter of Dod over Shaul. It's a very clear-cut translation. And
the inspired and authorized spokesperson versus the con man.
Yeah, the wannabe.
So
the wannabe
guy. Yeah, we
sorry.
Return to Ms. Moore. We don't have much more time, but Ms. Moore lyrics to be sung Psalm 89:29, which is where we were. It reads, "And I will establish his seed." He's speaking of Dod now. I mean, Dod is
mm-hmm.
the person who's named throughout this. "And I will establish his seed, that which he sows, and his offspring, as an eternal witness forever, and his throne shall be equated to the days of heaven. It is what Dode has sown through his words and through his life that creates the offspring that becomes part of the covenant. And he's not saying here that it's going to be one person who's going to be an eternal witness forever. No, it's what Dode sows that serves as an eternal witness forever. And, you know, God is the sovereign of this universe, but he doesn't like to work alone. So he's chosen one man to establish a throne throughout all time. Because for all time, we humans that are part of the covenant are going to be able to live in God's home and explore his universe. And we still need to have some sense of community and of interacting appropriately as a family. The head of the family is Dode, and his seat of honor shall be equated to the days of heaven. Well, the days of heaven, that's time everlasting.
Yeah, eternal.
Spiritual time.
Yes.
We, the covenant children, are the beneficiaries of what Dode has sown. We are his offspring and legacy, as well as his harvest. Through the Son, this Son, the Father has built a family. And as a result, his place of honor and his offspring shall endure forever, as filled with time as are the days of heaven. Now, there's no denying that Yao intends to establish Dode's seed and what he has sown, his offspring, his legacy as an eternal witness, all in irresolvable conflict with the Talmud, the New Testament, the Quran, and the Book of Mormon. And while that is all we need to know to capitalize on the lyrics he has written, trusting and relying on his mizmor to lead us home, we now know that heaven has a seat of honor, indeed a throne, one with Dode's name written on it. It's not just throughout the millennial kingdom that we should expect to see Dode govern as king, but
forever.
As heaven,
yeah,
as well, forever. I am delighted, man. I think it's wonderful.
I do too.
Truly. If the brightest among us gets to lead us, we're going to be enlightened. And, you know, and Dode's a fun guy. He's an adventurous guy. You know, Dode is quick-witted. He's articulate. He's a man's man. He's going to be fun to be around.
Absolutely.
Yeah. If we wish to be there with him, it's important that we realize that there is free will. There are choices that need to be made, alliances that need to be established, and some broken. Dode chose wisely, electing to closely examine and carefully consider Yahweh's Torah, his 119th Mizmor, the 22-stanza alphabetic presentation of the Torah remains the crowning achievement of his life.
That's brilliant.
Those misled by the likes of Paul, Akiba, and Muhammad will face the consequences of having chosen poorly, and in particular, Yehudim, the direct descendants of Dode. The next statement reads, however, if his children continue to forsake, ignore, or reject my Torah, and make a habit of failing to walk according to my means to justly resolve disputes, if they perpetually view my clearly communicated prescriptions for living with contempt and further, if they consistently fail to observe the instructive terms of the relationship, then I will hold them accountable with the measure of their rebellion. The consequence of their deviation from the way and their wrongdoing will be a pestilence which causes widespread death. Mizmor Psalm 89:32. Well,
that's pretty plain.
That's really it, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if Yah's children continue to forsake, ignore, or reject his Torah, they're disenfranchised. But what this says is that the thing that Yehudim and Yisrael were guilty of doing was continuing to forsake, ignore, and reject the Torah. Yeah. That means two things. One is that the Talmud isn't the Torah, because religious Jews are Talmud observant.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The second thing is that this is saying that the Torah can be accepted, the Torah can be observed,
mm-hmm.
Because it's the opposite of a zav. Rather than neglect it, we can focus on it. Rather than abandon it, we can embrace it. Rather than disavow it, we can acknowledge it. Rather than ignore it, we can observe it. But the choice to azab it is the one that leads to judgment. And look at Christianity. They have completely ignored Yahweh's Torah, as have Muslims. Ignoring the Torah leads to judgment, and it causes widespread death. Now, from the Torah, Yahweh has made a number of additional points. If you make a habit of failing to walk according to my means to resolve disputes, the mishpat. The mishpat, mm-hmm. is the path that Yahweh has provided,
yes.
to resolve the disputes which separate us. The mishpat are,
right.
the mikra.
Yeah.
It is a compound word that is comprised of ma, which means to ponder the implications of something,
mm-hmm.
and shafat, to make good decisions.
Yeah, judgmental.
Yeah, to be discerning, to be discriminating, to make good decisions. So ponder all the aspects of quality decision-making and how you resolve disputes. So if we're going to walk to God, we need to focus on his means to justly resolve disputes. If we choose to ignore them, then we're going to die. Those who ignore and reject and forsake Yahweh's Torah die. Those who fail to walk through the means that he has devised to resolve disputes, which is Pesach, Matzah, Bukurim, Shavua, Teruah, Kippurim, and Sukkah, die. If they perpetually view my clearly communicated prescriptions for living with contempt, the Chukka, they're going to die. And if they fail to observe the instructive terms of the relationship, the mitzvah, the conditions of the covenant, then God's going to hold them accountable for their rebellion. And as a consequence, they're going to die. So
you know,
any
Craig,
one of these things will kill you.
Yeah. You know, this reinforces what you've said for years and years and years. As you were reading that, I was thinking about the Moed Mikra. And it's more to it than just, okay, we're going to do this on Pesach and we're going to do this on Matzah and so forth. What he's asking you to do is to understand what it was, understand what Pesach was about, what was actually taking place, what Matzah is all about. So when you always said, you know, don't ask me what to do on these festival feasts, on these set-apart days.
Yeah.
Do try to understand what it is, because this is a teaching instrument above all things. And you, and the reason you learn is because you're trying to understand concepts and understand what they're about so that you can embrace those. It's not doing something. It's absolutely understanding it. So, I mean, from the very start, you have, that's been your answer to most people when they called or wrote to you. And it's really true. I mean, it's reinforced here. This is the Ma of the Mishpat.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, in the ninth Mizmor.
Yeah, consider what it means.
Dode actually writes in the ninth Mizmor, Yahweh is known. He becomes recognized and is acknowledged by us through his means to resolve disputes by exercising good judgment, his Mishpat. And the way that he engages and acts regarding these things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not just that God came up with these seven set-apart days, invitations for us to meet with him. He himself engaged in all of them for our benefit.
Correct.
And according to the ninth psalm, it's how we come to know Yahweh. So you've got the Torah teaching being essential for life, and to ignore it leads to death.
Mm-hmm.
You have walking in the means to justly resolve disputes and exercise good judgment, leading to life, and yet choosing to ignore them leads to death. You have God's clearly communicated prescriptions for living, that which has been engraved and cut into stone, constituted and inscribed, that lead to life, but to ignore them, to death. And if they fail to observe the instructive terms of the relationship, the mitzvah, they fail to examine and carefully consider the requirements of the covenant, then God's going to hold them accountable. You know, you don't want to be held accountable by God. You don't want to be judged by God.
No.
What this is saying is, if you embrace the Torah, if you observe the Torah, if you walk in the path that Yahweh has provided through his Mikra, if you observe the terms and conditions of the covenant, then you're not going to be held accountable. Then you're not going to be judged, and you're going to live.
Be happy. This is great. Hallelujah.
Right. So this is also a complete repudiation of faith and of Paul's letters. The central aspect of life is to observe the Torah.
Yeah.
And so those that do not are going to die. So it is the antithesis of what Paul has written. It negates completely the entire concept of a New Testament.
Yeah.
If you
that's why I called him.
Who is the person that was the most overt in the history of humanity for rejecting the Torah?
Paul.
He said the Torah can't save. Paul.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the consequence of their deviation from the way and their wrongdoing will be a pestilence, which causes widespread death. So Christians carry around the 89th Psalm in their Bibles.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it they can't read it? Why is it they can't process it?
Well,
no. By the way, these terms here are the mm-hmm. very terms that Dode uses to walk us through what's important about the Torah.
I believe you.
Oh, yeah, it's Chuka. And Mishpat.
Mishpat, yeah.
And Mitzvah, yeah.
And Bakuda.
Right. All the way through it, the same concepts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, according to God, souls who forsake the Torah die. The consequence of ignoring God's teaching is to endure the plague of death. To reject God's guidance, as Paul has done, is to be held accountable. There is no substitute and no getting around it, not with the Talmud or Gospels, and most certainly not with the Quran. The Torah is the key to heaven. It provides Yahweh's lone means to resolve disputes. Passover and unyeasted bread. Within it, we find Yahweh's clearly communicated prescriptions for living. Bikurim and Shavuah. Observing it leads the observant through Teruah to Kippurim and Sukkah. Reconciled and at home. Paul was wrong. Christians are wrong. It's the Torah, not faith. To deviate from Yahweh's Torah teaching through religious rebellion has devastating consequences, causing widespread death. Those who were infected by Paul's plague of death will die as a result of it. The New Testament is wrong. Annulling the Torah, forsaking, ignoring, and rejecting Yahweh's teaching and guidance is deadly. There is no cure, no salvation for those who fail to observe and appreciate God's means to resolve disputes or who hold his clearly communicated prescriptions for living in contempt. Yahweh's mercy is afforded to the thousands among billions who embrace the instructive terms of his relationship agreement. It's our choice.